Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our first look at the life and crimes of Rodney Alcala. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content such as our continuing look at the Atlanta child murders, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, both did. Lastly, I want to acknowledge the passing of two supporters and fans of this show and all-around good people. The first is Lucas Shoemaker, who passed a few weeks ago. Lucas was a really good guy. And secondly, a true crime fiend and friend of mine by the name of Jamie Hemmings, who passed away a few days ago. Both of you guys are going to be sorely missed. And Jamie, I am going to miss you picking my brain about various cases and also busting my balls concerning my love of the Canadian television show Corner Gas. I hope both of you rest in peace. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We're gonna start with the first of Alcala's known crimes, and then we're gonna work our way from there. On the morning of September 25th, 1968, 8-year-old Tally Shapiro was on her way to school when Alcala spotted her walking on the sidewalk. Alcala pulls up to Tally and offers her a ride to school. The little girl, by her own account, felt uneasy with the man. She didn't know him. She refused his ride. And the man began stating that he knew her parents, even calling the young girl by name. The reason for this was Tally had a name tag on her shirt, and Alcala saw this name tag. He gets Tally to get into his car and then proceeds to drive to his Hollywood apartment. Not long after this, the Los Angeles Police Department received a phone call from a passing motorist named Donald Haynes, who stated he had seen a man exiting a beige-colored car, dragging a child with him into an apartment. Some sources state that Alcala lured the young girl into his apartment, but according to the official police documentation, the motorist actually saw him pulling her into the apartment. According to Shapiro's later statement to police, Alcala told Shapiro that he wanted to show her a picture that he had inside of the apartment. A patrolman by the name of Chris Comancho received the call on his radio, and he later stated to 48 Hours, quote, "I was out doing my patrols. We just started our shift that day, and I was driving down Sunset Boulevard, and I had received a beige-colored car with no license plate following this little girl." Basically, what happened was this Donald Haynes had seen Alcala driving down the street, had seen him pull over, and had seen Tally get into his car, and he thought it was suspicious, so he decided to follow the car and see what happens. It's estimated that by the time Comanche reached the apartment, so Comanche is the first man on the scene. It was later estimated that Tally had been in the apartment for approximately 12 minutes. Comanche approaches the apartment, knocks on the door, identifies himself as a police officer, and states he needs to speak with whoever is inside. According to Comanche's later statements, the door was cracked open, held from fully opening by a security chain. The man on the other side had a olive drab complexion and was completely nude. The man informs Officer Comanche that he is taking a shower and he just needs to get dressed. At which point, the man closes the door in Comanche's face. Comanche waited a few seconds before drawing his revolver and kicking in the door. Now, there are conflicting reports as to what Comanche saw. Some state that he saw the man, who was nude, going out the back window. Others that he heard him escaping through a back exit in the apartment. However, when Officer Comanche gets into the apartment, he sees a young girl lying on the kitchen floor with blood all over the floor. She is nude, and there is a metal bar pressed down against her throat. Officer Comanche decides not to pursue the suspect and instead rushes over to the young girl, where, using a rag, he lifts the metal bar from her head and then turns her head slightly so the young girl can cough out whatever is inside of her throat, which turns out to be blood. Now, the blood on the floor, unfortunately, came from young Tally Shapiro's vagina, as she had been sexually assaulted. Now, as always, we have conflicting reports, with some reports stating that Comanche first went to search the apartment after removing the bar from Tally's throat and coming back to finding her breathing on the floor. In any event, the outcome is the same. Comanche radios for dispatch for an ambulance as well as for backup. While he's waiting for this backup, he starts to look through the apartment, notices a number of photographs spread out on the coffee table in the living room of young girls and women, all in various states of undress. And on the wall is hanging a diploma from UCLA with a Bachelor of Arts degree made out to Rodney Acala. So now they have the name of the suspect that they are looking for. However, even armed with this name, finding Acala is going to be extremely difficult. The officer who ends up being assigned to this case is somewhat of a legend in Los Angeles, a detective by the name of Steve Hodell, who, if you're not aware of him, he put out a book called The Black Dahlia Avenger, wherein he posits the idea that his father was the killer of Elizabeth Smart, the Black Dahlia, as well as the murderer of numerous other individuals. According to Hodell, they really had no bead on Acala at this point, and everyone that they spoke to gave a very similar story, that Rodney Acala was a really good guy, was very charming and outgoing, people liked him, that he would not hurt a fly. However, the officers knew better, and they really began in earnest to try and find Acala, who had fled the state in his car. And he's eventually going to turn up in New York City. Before we get to that, however, we're going to take a look at who this suspect is, who this Rodney Acala is. The man who would become infamous as Rodney James Acala was born Rodrigo Jacques Acala. However, some documents put his birth name as Rodrigo Jacques Acala Foucault on August 23rd, 1943 in San Antonio, Texas. I point out the difference in names as not all documents contain that last name of Foucault. Some stop at Acala, so it's difficult to officially know which one is the truth and which one is false. However, given the way that individuals from Mexico and South America are named, I figure it's probably more likely than not that the Bucor name was in fact his last name at birth. Numerous documents state that Acala, who was the third of four children, moved quite often during the early years of his childhood. He lived with his siblings as well as his parents and his grandmother until roughly the time he was 8 years old, when his grandmother became extremely ill and decided that she needed to return to Mexico. Acala's father decided that she would not return alone and that in fact the entire family would move with her. So in 1951, the family moves to Torreon, Mexico, where his father, that some records state was a school teacher, was able to find work. However, in 1954, things took a drastic change when Rodney's mother informed him that her husband had abandoned the family and fled back to the United States. Rodney's mother, Maria, informs her son that they are going to be moving themselves as his grandmother has passed away, and she relocates the family to Los Angeles, where she's able to find work while the family lives with her sister for a period of time until they get their feet under them. To the best of my knowledge, there isn't a lot in the way of information on Acala's earliest years. I'm talking in terms of, you know, problems with his personality, acting out, things of that nature. Some documents hold that Acala was picked on when they lived in Texas due to his Mexican nature. However, given the close proximity of Texas to Mexico, even in 1950s America, I find that highly doubtful. We do know that somewhere along the line, Acala became enamored with photography and that his mother ends up buying him a fairly inexpensive photograph, and that Acala spends the majority of his time taking pictures of various innocuous things. We also know that Acala was said to be an extremely bright, well-liked student by his teachers and other classmates. That said, there is a good deal of speculation that Acala grew a resentment towards his mother and sisters at somewhere during this point in time, and also that his father's abandoning the family devastated him emotionally, as, at least according to some sources, his father, Raul, was seen as Rodney's best friend, and this man leaving put a hole inside of Acala that nothing could fill. back on the school front, Alcala was involved with many different extracurricular activities, including sports such as track and field, along with various clubs. Again, there's speculation about the motives behind this next part of Alcala's life. As he got closer to graduation, he decided that rather than go directly to college where he would pursue a career in photography, he would join the United States Army, and the speculation comes in the form that Alcala's father had been in the Army, and this may have been Alcala's way of trying to connect with the father who was no longer there. So in 1958, Rodney Alcala graduates from high school and joins the U.S. Army, where after going through basic training, he is assigned to a battalion on Fort Bragg, where he works as an administration clerk. The following year, 1959, just about 4 months after Alcala had turned 18, he receives a letter at Fort Bragg informing him that his father, Raul, has passed away. Despite the fact that the man had abandoned the family, Alcala's mother, Anna Maria, reached out to her and informed her of when the funeral service would be, stating basically that you need to return for your father's funeral, which Alcala and his siblings do. Raul Alcala Buqua was 55 years old when he died at a hospital in Porterville, Texas. Alcala is able to get leave and travels to Tulare, Texas for the funeral, which is held on January 15th of 1959. Alcala learned when he got there that his father had remarried to a woman by the name of Virginia Bucher, and Alcala later told doctors that learning that his father had remarried after abandoning the family greatly distressed him. Returning to the Army, Alcala has a fairly unremarkable career until 1963, where at some point he suffers what is said to have been a nervous breakdown. Alcala then flees North Carolina and returns to Los Angeles, where he shows up at his mother's apartment. Eventually, the military track Alcala down, he is brought back to North Carolina, where he is given a battery of psychological examinations, and it is listed in his record that he has traits of an antisocial personality disorder, which, let's be clear, at this point, antisocial personality wasn't really looked at as a thing. More often than not, they would say that the individual was a psychotic or a sociopath, but now in this PC world, we have antisocial personality disorder. Anyways, Alcala is labeled as having an antisocial personality, as being narcissistic, and having no form of empathy. And on these grounds, Alcala is found to be unfit for military service and is released on medical grounds. While I have not found anything to indicate that Alcala was given any form of disability in terms of financial aid from the military, which would have been very unlikely during this period of time, he does enroll in UCLA upon returning to California. He also decides to change his name. When he had been in North Carolina, stationed at Fort Bragg, Alcala later stated that he received an extensive amount of racially motivated taunting and abuse from his fellow soldiers, which led him to feel like an outsider and not part of. And because of this, he decides that he no longer wants to be Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucor, so he legally changes his name to Rodney James Alcala. Alcala, by this point, is said to be very charming, although those who know him say there are periods of quiet from him when he does not display any form of emotion, and in fact, it appears from all accounts that he very rarely let anyone inside to know just what exactly was going on with him mentally and emotionally. Now, that honestly, that's not that unheard of, especially during this period of time that we're talking, the 1960s. But Alcala took it a step further, and anything that was going on that was really bothering him stayed with him. He did not share any of this type of thing, even with his closest family members. We know he graduated with a fine arts degree from UCLA in 1968. We also know that upon his 21st birthday, his father's widow gave him his inheritance. I have not seen anything to indicate how much that inheritance was, although it appears to have been a significant amount, as Alcala does not appear to have held any form of steady employment during this period of time, instead choosing to spend his days taking photographs of women in and around Los Angeles, either with or without their consent. The without their consent part is simply that Alcala would take voyeuristic photographs of women through their windows. He started to build an MO at this point in time. He would walk around with the camera he had purchased hanging around his neck and approach young girls, for the most part, telling them that he was a fashion photographer and he would like to take pictures of them. And this would be Rodney Alcala's modus operandi from this point forward. He would take photographs of young girls as well as of women. Some of these photographs, the women were fully dressed. Others, they were, you know, in various states of undress, while in others, they were in sexually explicit poses. And this is one of the things that has led investigators to speculate for decades as to the true number of Rodney Alcala's victims. We know when he is eventually arrested at the end of the 1970s, he has at least 1,000 photographs. When he flees Los Angeles later in 1968, there is already a considerable amount of pictures of women in these various states inside of his apartment, so the true number of Alcala's victims is unknown, as is unknown when he decided to begin raping and attempting to murder women. As I stated at the beginning of this episode, his first known victim was 8-year-old Tally Shapiro, who miraculously ends up surviving her encounter with Rodney Alcala, although she is in a coma for, some sources state, 20 days, others that she was in this coma for 32 days. In any event, Shapiro survives, and it takes her months to recover. Eventually, after recovering, her family flees the country and heads to Mexico, something that, unfortunately, in the years to come, is going to allow Rodney Alcala to continue on with the escalation of his crimes. Now, after fleeing from Los Angeles in September of 1968, Rodney Alcala relocates to New York City, where he enrolls in NYU, that is New York University, under an alias of John Berger. As John Berger, Alcala is able to get into the NYU film school, specifically, and this is something that has been pointed out for decades, although it's often spoken of but never really looked at, Alcala was chosen by Roman Polanski. Roman Polanski, the film director and widower of Sharon Tate of the infamous Manson murders, to be in a class that Roman Polanski was given. Polanski was taken with Alcala's photography and chose him to participate in this course that he was given. As I said, it's always mentioned, but people don't really look at it. We don't know what types of photographs Alcala submitted in order to get into this prestigious course that Polanski was given. Some have speculated that some of these photographs may have been of a sexual nature, and as Polanski is widely regarded as being something of a sexual predator, it may be that he saw something of himself in this individual and decided to include him in the course. Again, that's speculation. I know Polanski is rather litigious, despite the fact that he fled this country after raping a 13-year-old girl. In any event, Alcala is enrolled in NYU, and in the summer of 1971, he gets a part-time job as a counselor, again as John Berger, although this time under a different spelling, in New Hampshire at a arts camp, Camp New Beginning, which is located in the village of George's Mills, where it's said that Alcala spent a good deal of his time photographing the young girls who went to the camp, although we do not know whether or not any of these photographs were of an explicit or consensual nature. The best information that I have been able to find is that Alcala used his camera to take voyeuristic pictures of these young girls while he was at the camp. Unbeknownst to Alcala, Detective Steve Hedell had continued his pursuit of the man responsible for the brutal assault of Tally Shapiro, and he is eventually able to get the Los Angeles Police Department to contact the FBI, who, upon learning everything that the LAPD was able to discover about Alcala, places him on their 10 most wanted list. At least that's the narrative that's out there. But, bombshell time, people, I could find no evidence on any website, including the FBI's own website, that lists Rodney Alcala as being on the top 10 most wanted fugitives list. If you look at anything concerning Alcala, it states that he was put onto the list in 1971. But according to the FBI, no one was placed onto the list in 1971. That doesn't mean that the FBI didn't put out a wanted poster for him. It simply means that the often reported fact that Rodney Acala was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list is incorrect. Therefore, it never happened. Now, the FBI did create a wanted poster for Rodney Acala, which it sent out to post offices, etc., as it did routinely when updating the most wanted list. However, not all of these wanted posters were for individuals that were on that list. They were just other individuals that the FBI was interested in having apprehended. And I think that's more likely than not where the confusion comes from in terms of Acala being put on the list when he never, in fact, was. In any event, we know that a wanted poster had been generated for Acala at least by June 23rd of 1971. We also know that Acala learned of this wanted poster on or around that day. On this same day, Acala meets a 23-year-old stewardess for Transworld Airlines, also known as TWA, named Cornelia Crilly. Now, where exactly they met is left up to speculation. Authorities believed that Acala may have met Crilly inside of a bar, talked her up, and convinced her that he could help her move into her new ground floor apartment, where he violently assaulted, raped, and then murdered Crilly with a pair of nylon stockings which he tied around her throat. The next day, Cornelia's boyfriend, one Leon Borstein, arrives at the apartment and goes inside, only to find his girlfriend bound to the bed with nylon ropes, naked, a pair of panties stuffed inside of her mouth, and the pair of stockings still cinched tight around her neck. There were various bruises on her body, along with bite marks on her breasts. Officers from the NYPD were unable to find anything beyond DNA evidence, which at that point in time really was insignificant, as they had no means by which to test it and link it to any suspect. Transworld Airlines ends up giving a $5,000 reward who could help them discover the identity of Crilly's killer. The next week sees Rodney Acala as George Berger at the camp in New Hampshire. So the week after Cornelia Crilly is murdered, two of the girls are at the local post office sending postcards to their family when one of the girls notices all of the FBI wanted posters. Again, this is not the FBI's 10 most wanted, so let's get that idea out of our head that Rodney Acala was considered at this point to be such a dangerous and depraved suspect that he was on it. Looking at these pictures, these wanted posters, they see a photograph of the man they know as Mr. Berger and immediately are shocked. Returning back to the camp, the two girls inform their director of the camp of what they saw at the post office. at which point the director travels to the post office and confirms what the two girls have told him. After this, he contacts the FBI, who in turn put him in contact with Officer Steve Hedell in Los Angeles. After speaking with the director, Hedell informs him not to let anyone else know about this information and to tell the two campers to keep this information to themselves. He then goes and talks to his superiors in the Los Angeles County Police Department. Hedell is then booked on a flight to New Hampshire. Hedell links up with members of the New Hampshire State Police, and on Saturday, June 19th, 1971, exactly 1 week after Cornelia Criley was murdered in her apartment, Hedell and members of the New Hampshire State Police arrive at the camp and remove Alcala from a fitness lecture that he is giving the campers and place him under arrest for the 1968 rape and attempted murder of Tally Shapiro. After getting Alcala back to the state of California, it was learned that the Shapiro family had moved out of the country and would not allow their daughter to testify against Rodney Alcala, which basically means the state has no case against him. Now, even though they cannot charge him for the crimes that he committed, they are able to charge Alcala with assault, and he ends up pleading guilty to this and receiving an indeterminate sentence, which was very prevalent in the state of California during this period of time, as it was thought that sex offenders could be rehabilitated. And what an indeterminate sentence basically means is that they can hold you in prison for an unspecified period of time. The agreement that Alcala signs means that he will be in prison for a period of at least 1 year. Alcala is sent to the Chino Correctional Facility in San Bernardino County. After serving roughly 34 months, Rodney Alcala is released in September of 1974 and paroled to Los Angeles County. Alcala had always been a charismatic and charming individual, and this was on display when he went before the parole board and stated, quote, "At the time of the horrible crime, my judgment was impaired by the effects of drugs, and I now deeply regret the pain and suffering I have caused to Tally Shapiro and her family." In addition to being paroled, the parole board gave Alcala a letter to give to any prospective employers, stating that in the eyes of the California penal system, he was considered completely rehabilitated. Moving back in with his mother, Alcala gets a job working as a photographer for a local small-time entertainment magazine. On the afternoon of Sunday, October 13th, 1974, Alcala decided to go to Huntington Beach, which is located in South Los Angeles, taking along with him his camera. Upon arriving at Huntington Beach, which was, during this period of time, considered to be cleaner and much less crowded than Long Beach, he sees a young girl sitting at a bus stop. Alcala is able to persuade this young girl, who is only listed as Julie J, to go for a ride with him. Alcala drove them to a secluded area where he proceeded to roll two joints for them. And as they sat there talking on this clifftop area, a park ranger arrives, noticing the stench of marijuana in the air. Rodney Acala is placed under arrest. Rodney Acala ends up being convicted for a parole violation as well as contributing to the delinquency of a minor, where he is first sent to the Chino Correctional Facility and then the men's colony in San Luis Obispo, which is in Santa Maria. As he had done during his first incarceration, Rodney Acala makes use of the prison's various rehabilitation and self-betterment programs, eventually winning parole again in 1977. Amazingly, when Acala is released in May of that year, he is considered to be completely rehabilitated and actually taken off of supervised parole. Acala is able to convince his parole officer that it would be a good idea if he were to return to New York. Not much is known about what Acala did once he got to New York as far as how he paid his way, where he lived in terms of having an apartment, etc., etc. We do know is that he attempted to get his job back at the camp in New Hampshire and was turned down for it, at which point he returns to New York, and at some point during the week leading up to July 15th, Rodney Acala is believed to have met a woman by the name of Ellen Hoover. Now, Hoover was the 23-year-old daughter of a nightclub owner by the name of Herman Hoover, and because of her father's job, Helen was actually the goddaughter of both Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. What happened next is purely speculation, insofar as we don't know when Acala met Ellen Hoover, nor do we know with absolute certainty that he is in fact the one responsible for her disappearance and murder. However, there's a good number of clues that point to Rodney as being the man responsible. In her diary for the date of July 15th, 1977, Ellen scrawled, "John Berger, photographer, 8 p.m. I have read some reports that indicate that Ellen Hoover was driven to a secluded area near the Hudson River where Rodney Acala assaulted her repeatedly, strangling her into unconsciousness on multiple occasions before actually taking her life. Again, these are accounts that have been published, however, I cannot say with absolute certainty that this is in fact the case. As far as her manner of death, whether or not Acala tortured her, we do know that she ends up being buried in a shallow grave and is placed inside of it nude, and then this grave, after being filled in, is covered with boulders. Interestingly enough, this grave, which is on the shores of the Hudson Bay, was actually on the estate of John D. Rockefeller. Some have speculated as other bodies have been found on this piece of property over the years that something nefarious is going on with the Rockefeller family in connection to all of this. Usually when this topic of conversation comes up, there's talk of a satanic cult. However, during the course of my research and investigation, I found no evidence to support this claim. In any event, after Ellen goes missing, the following day, Rodney Alcala decides to return to Los Angeles, telling his parole officer that the things he was hoping to accomplish in New York just didn't pan out and he wants to return home. So he does so, moving back in with his mother for a short period of time. With Alcala back in Los Angeles, nobody knows what has happened to Ellen Hoover. 2 days after she disappears, so on July 17th, one of her friends reports her as missing to the New York City Police Department in Manhattan, and her apartment, located at 686 3rd Avenue, is searched, and it's during this search that officers find the diary entry concerning John Berger. As discussed numerous times on this show, police in the 1970s up through the 1990s, and even still today a little bit, rarely if ever communicated with one another. The best that they could hope for was that the FBI would get involved in a case and agree to publish the facts of a particular crime on a national basis, as they had done in the 1971 with Rodney Alcala. So police in New Hampshire and in Los Angeles had no idea that this young woman had gone missing, or that she had had an appointment with a man named John Berger on the date of her disappearance. Now, the Hoover family is obviously worried about their daughter's whereabouts. They offer a $100,000 reward for information leading to their daughter's whereabouts. They also go about hiring a private investigator. Although, as you're going to see, it's going to be a considerable period of time before Ellen Hoover's body is discovered. We're going to end the show at this point with Rodney Alcala having committed one sexual assault and two assaults and murders, and pick it back up next week. Hope that you guys have enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay morbid.